greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. The evidence for human impact on the world's climate is overwhelming. Denial is an option, but not a very smart one. Global climate change threatens our ways of living and our lives. David Orr publicly acknowledges the problems and works diligently to find or create solutions.
It's not solvable. We've already committed to a substantial warming of the planet. That cannot be undone by any known means. So what can occur is we can contain the worst of what would otherwise lie ahead. And then how do we do that? And that gets into all these kinds of changes. That gets into people understanding that you've got to vote for green candidates, not because it's a nice thing to do, it's an essential thing to do. And people who understand things like feed-in tariffs, and like energy technology and smart grid, people who've taken the trouble to understand the issues and what can be done about it. And what can be done to avoid the worst of what lies ahead is really quite substantial. So I think the only legitimate, you can't go to despair, as Gandhi said, and as we all know, that's a sin. And optimism, you just don't know enough. So hope is a sweet spot. And that's the place where we need to be. And it's mandatory on us to be hopeful. But to be hopeful means you're active. I mean, it is that verb with the sleeves rolled up. You've got to be doing things.
David Orr's seventh book is Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. He helped launch the Green Campus movement and led the creation and construction of the first green building on a U.S. college campus, the iconic Adam Joseph Lewis Center at Oberlin College. He is distinguished professor and special assistant to its president. David Orr, we have a brand new baby in our extended family. He was born 10 days ago, and when I held this tiny little creature, thank you very much, I looked at this little Nicholas and I said, what kind of a world have we brought you into, you beautiful child? What's ahead for you? You're going to live 79 years, and I'm kind of worried about this beautiful little thing. And what kind of a world we've brought him into, and that which will be unfolding. Should I suggest to his parents that they shouldn't have done this? Do we have a way to give his parents hope rather than optimism? Where are we when we look at what we're just on the verge of doing with this tiny, beautiful creature? Grandfather?
Well, I have four. The title of the book is Down to the Wire, and I think that's exactly where we are. We're coming to the hinge point of history. So when the writer of Deuteronomy said, you know, way back when, that I put before you life and death, choose life that you and your seed may live abundantly, no generation until ours could say that or could face that choice with the finality with which we face that choice. And so when you look at the scientific dialogue about global trends and the public discourse, there's a Grand Canyon Gulf. And for us in the education world, the media world, we've got to close that Grand Canyon or build a bridge across it.
You say that so, as if we were talking about the United States. We're talking about the world, aren't we?
We are talking about the world.
And yes, the United States has a long way to go, and none of this can happen if we are not all working toward a common end of life on Earth?
That's right. And it's life on Earth that is badly divided in terms of income, badly divided in terms of the responsibility for getting us to this situation where it is down to the wire. The United States bears a disproportional responsibility, certainly in terms of carbon emissions, for climatic change that's pending in front of us. And so, it's a world issue, but we in the United States have got to act first, boldly, creatively, and we're not moving nearly fast enough.
This is an existential condition, and I don't mean purely philosophically. We're talking about the existence at least under current circumstances, according to our expectations, mm-hmm. the existence of us, but also of lots of other species. This is,
right.
you know, this is not optional. And yet nobody seems to want to talk about it. You've finally stepped up. I mean, you've been talking about it, but in public saying the kinds of things that need to be said.
Well, the finally is, oh my God, stuff that isn't being Cassandra is simply saying, here it is, what you going to do?
You know, part of the reason for writing the book is that even on our side of the table, people who agree that this is an issue, and environment's important, and we've got to change lots of things. Even on our side, there is a level of, kind of, call it what you will, it looks like denial. It is to say that, yes, we know what the trends are, we know what the science is, but we can't tell the public. And because that would, they would fall into despair. And we've got to put what Gus Speth at Yale calls happy talk out there. And so you get lots of books, 50 Ways to Save the Planet and Make a Profit, Solving the Climate Crisis at a Profit. And that's not what the science says. That is not, now it may be that we have to tell, as Socrates once is reported to have said, noble lies. But they're lies nonetheless. And most of us don't do very well on lies. And so the book is about, and I weigh this in the book, you know, I don't have any magic communication strategy, but it's to say, tell people the truth about this and equip them to understand the truth, which is science education. But the fact is that we're at 390 parts per million CO2 right now, and if you look at what's called CO2 equivalent numbers, we're at about 430, give or take. And we're even with the economic downturn, we added 2 parts per million to the level of carbon last year.
And the number that Bill McKibben has socialized is 350 for a reason.
Well, 350 is the number, and this comes from James Hansen's work. 350 is it's the last point of safety, and above 350, and it isn't necessarily that things are safe below 350. That's the fine print of Hansen's argument. He really does say we've got to get back to 300. And so above 350, however, what we do is to set up or create a condition where these positive feedback cycles, most of them having a lot to do with methane, which is a more potent, shorter-term greenhouse gas, but a more potent greenhouse gas considerably than carbon dioxide is, molecule for molecule. And all these methane beds in permafrost and in what are called methane clathrates or hydrates in seabeds. And so if we warm the planet enough, then we trigger things that we are really not going to like, that are very sudden. And the record, the scientific record, indicates that climate can flip decade. And all of a sudden, you've run the temperature up 3, 4, 5 degrees centigrade, not Fahrenheit.
That's so, more. We did a program about,
it was 2000.
It was 1999, the very first issue of the Atlantic Monthly for the year 2000 was with William Calvin. He wrote that cover story.
Right.
He called it, and was simply, he's a neurobiologist.
Neurophysiologist.
But he was talking about the very clear indications coming out of the ice cores that over and over again we've had what he termed climate flip-flops.
That's right.
Let's see, you melt the all of the ice in Greenland, you stop the North Atlantic conveyor and you've got a radically different set of problems.
Well, you know, the knowledge of the Earth as a physical system is so new. When I learned biology way back in, 1880.
The Dark Ages when
Pre-Darwin. You basically dissected frogs and things like that.
Yeah.
But now the technology and satellites and remote reconnaissance and computers allow us to see the planet whole and to begin to think about it. But that science is very, very new. And so understanding how human forcing of climate and what it does, and it is a global issue. But what this means, and this is the problem, I think, with a lot of public perception. I started the book with a quote from David Archer, who's a geophysicist at the University of Chicago. And he said, the effects of putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will last longer than Stonehenge, longer than time capsules, longer than nuclear waste. Susan Solomon, earlier this year in January, had a piece in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in which he says that ocean sea levels will continue to rise for 1,000 years even if we were to stop emitting carbon immediately. And so we've set in motion things that we're quite unaccustomed to. And so what the argument of the book is very simply that that being so, that the science being what it is, it's gone past the point of being simply a technological problem, although it is partly. And it's gone past the point of being simply an economic issue, although it clearly has to do with economics. It's now an issue of governance and ethics. And governance are the how we conduct the public business. And so markets are great and economics are great. You know, we corporations need to step up, and some like Ray Anderson's interface company certainly have, and there are others. But when the bad news hits, the market isn't going to save us. You have three Katrina scale events, let's say within the same 2 month period, markets won't be there, but governments will have to be. And so this is an issue of governance. And then this is an issue of ethics in the sense that in our constitutional history, we have the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment to talk about the rights of all of us to life, liberty, and property, and maybe from the Declaration of Independence, a bit of happiness along the way. But the effects now of what one generation does can spill into the future. So what our behavior or our dereliction can cast a very long, dark shadow on the future. And this is kind of like the issue of abortion writ large. And so some of the arguments about the abortion of a fetus now apply to whole generations.
And there's so much more to be said. Let me say three things. This year happens to be the year 2009. The book of which he speaks is Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. And it's worth noting, those fogs that we dissected when we were collectively in college, they're in big trouble.
Yeah.
We're all going to be back with David Orr in just a moment. We trust that you'll return with us. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. We are with David Orr in Oberlin, Ohio. Bill Russell?
The same baby that Paula was looking at, talking with their parents. There's something you say in this book that is, I knew it, but I had not registered it. It's as if with this child, I punched him, which would be a nasty thing to do.
This is a newborn. It can break.
And he isn't going to know. My action isn't going to show up for 30 years. And I think that's part of what confuses us so much about this issue. It is, you know, it's sort of the slow motion. A lot of it's happening other places. But that time lag is very confusing. We are already well down paths. I mean, part of the challenge seems to be we think we still got a little time. I'll get to it next week.
Yeah.
But we're already well down the slope.
We're already at 2039, effectively, sitting here in 2009.
We're seeing ice melt quite unpredictably and quite unexpectedly in Antarctica and Greenland and the North Pole at rates we didn't understand or appreciate or expect, even as late as 2005.
Mm.
And so if you simply look at the scientific evidence here, this is it's getting bigger, it's getting faster. And, you know, I say this to audiences all over the country, but if when you stand behind a podium, if I was to reach back behind a podium and pull out a shotgun and kind of ram a couple of shells, you know, snap it shut and walk toward the audience, I have their attention, because what kicks in is their adrenal fight-flight mechanism. They're either going to head for the door or rush me, but there's something going to happen. But when they see on the screen behind me parts per million and parts per billion, that's a snoozer. People don't get that. So we have to, we in education, I think, have to equip people to understand that your future, your career, your life, your livelihood, everything you count on, everything you love and hold dear, depends on your understanding how the world works as a physical system. And most people don't. New climate data being released by Yale University, Tony Lacerowitz at Yale. And what they've done is to look at climate knowledge, people all around the world. And we are the most confused of the developed countries. Americans and the number of people saying that they think this is a serious problem has dropped back to 55%. It's declined nearly, I think it's 20%. Half of those still don't believe that humans are the cause of the problem. Now, this gets us real quickly into issues of governance. This is not a marketable, solvable problem. This means that the control of the airwaves, of which you're a part and I'm a part, Those are public airways. That's the public comments. But they're being used to confuse and muddy the water, and that's a political issue.
Well, we talk about this a lot. It's as if we've got the circus going on the public airways while the city of Rome is built.
It's worse than that. I've been thinking about this, and your book drove it. There's a classic line about yelling fire in a theater and how it's considered bad form to do that. We have a large portion of the nominal political class in this country and the media who not only yell fire in the theater, that's all they do. They walk in yelling fire. They yell fire during the movie. They yell fire and all the way through it. Mm-hmm.
And they're lying.
I think one of the major challenges is we have allowed ourselves, I mean, we've been entertained to death or about to be entertained to death, but we've allowed ourselves to engage those people in a conversation, and they're a very small minority.
I agree. You know, there are two things that strike you about this. Three things, maybe. Our response to the Cold War was such, or to the rise of the Soviet Union after World War II, was such that we measured threats in parts per billion. And there was nothing we wouldn't pay to do. And that was always kind of a hypothetical.
Well,
we know
it
now,
also
having
turned
gotten
out
into
not
the archives,
to be the case.
That there was really no plan to take out the United States unless they thought we were going to do it first. But we paid, there was no price that we wouldn't pay, no burden we wouldn't bear.
And then we did.
The same thing, if, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck have made themselves, and Sean Hannity made themselves very noisy on this issue.
And very rich.
And very rich. And yet if one of the three of them, or their listeners and fans, finds a lump or feels a sudden heart pain, they go to a doctor, and the doctor says, well, look, you've got to have an operation, and here's what we have to do. It's not dismissed as, oh, well, that's a liberal thing. They may want a second opinion. But they treat science when it comes to the Earth and the future of all life on the planet, and science when it comes to their own body, in radically different ways. And there's a third thing about this, and this gets into conjecture. If I can go out on a limb for just a moment. In the 20th century, we had, looking at human behavior, we had to come up with words like genocide. That didn't exist. There probably had been genocide before. Well, we know there was genocide back in history. But it was so bad and so industrialized and so cold-blooded, and just stone cold, mean, and evil. We had to come up with a word for it, and words like Holocaust and genocide. And what is the language that we would use for people who encouraged us, who lied to us, in an attempt to encourage us to risk the fate of the entire Earth? What's the language? What are the words? Let alone the laws that would prohibit that. You have no right to confuse and to muddy the water on issues that when everything is at stake. And that debate hasn't begun. I don't know where to begin that debate, but that's a legal but moral issue.
Interestingly enough, the cup that I carry and use so as not to use styrofoam has emblazoned on it the Universal Rights of Human...
Universal Declaration of
Declaration
Human Rights.
Declaration of Human Rights, yeah.
Thank you. I drink from the cup. I don't read it.
It's in the small print.
It is that kind of thinking that must begin to be global, that must begin to be universal rights of all living beings, because what you're talking about isn't just humanity. You're talking about species that are falling by the wayside in just calamitous numbers. You're talking about changes that are so profound that life will not be recognized as it is today. This will look like Eden because it will have changed so much.
Well, you have, in the case of Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, I'm told that they never set foot in a college, or certainly a college science class. And so before they're allowed to pontificate about climate change, there ought to be some effort to, by their employers, to inform them about, here's how the Earth works, physical system. It isn't Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. It's just how it works as a system. But
there's no money in
that. Well, I think people have a right to be stupid in public if they want to be stupid in public.
It's called the First Amendment.
It's the First Amendment, and I think that's a very important attribute. And in fact, I wish we would use it more than rather than less.
Right.
So much of the challenge. This is the classic: if good men do nothing, and women, then bad things are going to happen. And a lot of it, and we're all, you've been out front and very public for a long time. A lot of us sat quietly and assumed that these people would see the light, or it didn't matter that they didn't know what they were talking about because they really had no influence. Which turned out not to be the case. And I think part of what's so important about what you've done is you've said publicly, forcefully, intelligently, accessibly, which is not always easy, what the case is, without overstating it, but also for the first time, pretty much in public, without understating it, which is very important. I say all that because rather than... I'm very reluctant to tell somebody they can't say what they want to say.
You know, I agree. And here's the rub. The First Amendment is incredibly valuable. So valuable that you don't give some people the right to a huge megaphone and other people virtually the right to no megaphone.
Absolutely.
And so what's happened is that the Supreme Court, in a decision, I think in 1977, Buckley versus Vallejo,
right,
said that the rights of free speech are also held by corporations. And this is a chain of legal logic that goes back to a decision by the Supreme Court.
A not decision.
The Santa Clara County decision.
A not decision.
Which was, never made. It's something written in the headnotes by the secretary to the court.
Who was a railroad lawyer.
That's
former.
Right. That's
corrupt.
Right. Corrupt. And the Chief Justice, Justice Waite here in Toledo, was not feeling very well. And so Bancroft was the guy that wrote this thing that said ostensibly that the court acknowledged that corporations are legal persons.
And since we are based on common law, that then accreted to a place where they are treated that way.
Well, the mischief in that is so obvious. And the mischief is that you and I are persons. And so we're mortal. We can only be in one place at one time. We have assets limited. We're going to die. And we are ethical creatures. Corporations are none of the above. And so to say that a corporation has the rights of free speech in the same manner that you and I have those rights. And so there was a corruption of that First Amendment way back when. And that
was both the First and the 14th Amendment, which gave rights to black men. But who? Mm-hmm. So it was also playing on another part of the Constitution that got warped.
That's right.
Well, you
which reminds us that the Constitution is a human document.
Well, the Civil War amendments, 13, 14, 15 exactly. amendments, were aimed at something radically different. They were corrupted in that era, and we've never gone back to correct the corruption. So, Bill, I agree that the First Amendment, freedom of speech, is incredibly important. It is so important, it should not be corrupted. And the size of the megaphone, as much as we can possibly make this in public policy, by access over the commons, we call it airwaves, ought to be as equal as possible. And so the big change here, of course, was the way the fair and balanced
Fairness was undermined.
Fairness doctrine of 1949 was undermined by Reagan FCC.
Pretty much tossed.
And so you can go south of here and you get into a bubble where about all the commentary and news is right-wing talk radio. And I can't challenge that. The FCC won't entertain the challenges. And so what the public gets, in the study done by the Center for American Progress a few years ago, 91% of talk radio is extreme right wing. And by definition, they don't think climate change is an issue. But they won't let somebody else on the program. And those other radio stations or television stations tend to think of balance as you have say Jim Hansen on, and then you put a Richard Lindzen on. And the fact that Hansen speaks for 99.9% of the people who study climate for a living and have to live by the rigors of peer review, logic, data, fact, and evidence doesn't matter. You always have to have someone else. As if the rights of your grandchild are going to be debated by Mother Teresa and Heinrich Himmler. And we call
I'll
that
say
somehow
that again.
Balance.
That would be Mother Teresa and Heinrich Himmler. That would be the bad guys, I mean the baddest of the bad guys.
Well, it'd be fair and balanced by this corrupted definition of it.
And it is a corrupted definition. It's worth saying that one of the things you've done brilliantly in Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse, is to go through and talk about the evidence. You have done a masterful job in going across all kinds of things that all of us should have read, and most of us haven't, and putting it all in one place so that it's not conjecture. This is the evidence. Mm-hmm. you like it or leave it, I'm going to treat you as adults. Imagine that. Sentient beings, and let you have a chance to think about it. And then when we come back in a moment, act on what we should know, must know, and can know moving forward. We're in Oberlin, Ohio. Actually, we're in the president's office of Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, which will become relevant as we continue the conversation. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, David Orr. Please be with us when we return in a moment. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. David Orr has been at that leading edge for decades now. Bill
Leading
Russell?
Edge, I think it's bleeding edge, well, isn't it?
Sometimes.
One edge is a two-edged sword.
I say that over decades part because none of these things are abstractions to you. We have lived in the American South for 30 years. You lived in the American South for 15 or 20 years. Well, over the last 30 years, a number of times, Experiencing what happens when it gets really hot for a really long time is not trivial. I vividly remember, I think it was 1980, when we were living in Alabama, and there that summer there was a stretch when for, I don't remember, it was 3 or 4 weeks, no day did it get cooler than 100 degrees, and no night did it get cooler than the high 90s. Mm-hmm. And after a month of that, your idea of climate change has been radically altered, right?
Well, summer 1980, I was in Arkansas, and that was the hottest, driest summer. I think it still holds the record in Arkansas history. And Mount St. Helens erupted in, I think it was early June, when the cloud of ash crossed over Arkansas. That was the last measurable rainfall we had until late October. 59 out of 60 days, it went over 100 degrees. So that was the new benchmark for me. That was hot.
And it was no fun.
No.
Well, and this goes to a serious concern in the United States, which is a lot of people live next to the ocean. It's a nice place to live. a lot of people, fewer, but many live in the Midwest, in the interior of the country, and the predictions are very hard because we're dealing with extraordinarily complex systems, nonlinear feedback, lots of different attributes. However, the sea level is rising, and the sea level, if certainly the more current estimates are that we are going to have to depopulate large sections of our coastal areas. Florida, I think, will be an archipelago soon. But large, New York City, San Francisco less, but around the edges, but a tremendous number of people are going to have to be moved at a time when we have serious resource constraints. And then you start looking at the political issues around that, the economic issues
around
that.
And we're the rich country.
The ethical issues around that. No, it's not even to talk about Bangladesh, which is disappearing before our eyes, or actually not before our eyes, because we don't talk about it, we don't show it. But it seems to me that the reality of that is one would think that by now people would begin to be paying attention, and yet, as you say, they don't seem to be paying attention. Why is that?
Next question.
Let me filibuster for a moment. We all try to do too much, and I found years ago that anything that was below number 3 on my to-do list just didn't get done. And I think a lot of people, the people that, as you say, are on your side of the table, our side of the table, we know it's a problem, it's number 4 on the list. And I'm dealing with, number 1's a real, and number 2, and number 3, and I'll get to 4 tomorrow, or next week, or whatever. Sure. And we're going to next week ourselves out of existence, literally.
there's no good short answer to the question. But in some ways, again, evolution wired us not to be very effective in these kinds of cases. We are really good if it's quick, hairy, and mean.
And we'll bite you.
And we are part of the food chain. We're not so good if it's slow, kind of erosive, distant in time. We're just not good. We have to think our way through this. And what we hear on this side of the chasm, public discourse here, and this side is the science. And what the science says is that for just the United States, the Southwest will become largely uninhabitable. The 4 million people in Phoenix won't have water, and it's going to be too hot to live there. The Midwest will be part, as all mid-continent areas will be, apparently, of a long-term drying process. They will desiccate, and there are studies that show that we won't be able to grow wheat in the wheat belt in the United States.
Australia is a very good example of that right now.
It's happening right now.
And then the Southeast, where you've been living for years and where I lived for a long time, the Southeast becomes hotter and drier, and ecosystems shift. You change the hydrology and rainfall, and lots of other things change. Storms get bigger. So rainfall may or may not stay the same, but rainfall events get bigger, and we've seen that trend through the whole 20th century and now in the 21st century. And so,
which means floods.
Floods, yeah. Runoff is much faster, diseases change, sea levels rise.
Strips the topsoil.
And what we do with this, and now what we do in a college, we put this into courses in hydrology over here and atmospheric physics over here, and so it's kind of like watching fireflies of a summer night. You see, there's a little light here, a little light here, and now we have to connect dots. And the only effective response is to understand how these things connect. And then we know better than we act. All of us do. And so even if I know that that's the truth, it is still very difficult to summon the wherewithal to act. And so now we have to, and we don't have much time. So now we have to act.
And that not much time is within months and years, not decades and centuries.
Well, you know, the time thing, Paula, is interesting, because if you ask James Lovelock, arguably the best independent scientist in the world, who's now 90, James Lovelock has written two books, his last one subtitled A Final Warning. And basically, Lovelock believes it's all over, that we've now tripped Gaia into a whole different phase, and that we'll see this warming trend, and then he argues, he believes from his own data, that there'll be a cooling trend, which will lull us, and then all of a sudden a sudden spike to the what he is calling the final warning or final warming, and so we're not now true or not. I don't know. I'm not really a scientist. I read scientists, but we're not accustomed to think about this.
A final warming could make us into Mars.
And the issue for us, and Bill, several of us, 250 of us, got together and worked on what we call the President's Climate Action Plan. And it was handed off to the Obama administration after the election. It was designed for either Republican or Democrat, it didn't matter, but it refocused on the first 100 days of the next U.S. administration. And in that, it's a large, thick document. It's A to Z, 13 major chapters. It's transportation, agriculture, forestry, everything. And in that, the question for the leader of the United States, and this, I mean, to the extent the president is the leader, was what do you tell the public and how do you say it? And this puts you in the old Jack Nicholson movie where Tom Cruise confronts Jack Nicholson about a murder on the base, and where Nicholson's a commandant, and Nicholson goes into this very eloquent statement of defense of what he does to provide freedom for people like this young JAG attorney. And finally, he says, you just can't handle the truth. And there's a viewpoint there that we can't handle the truth. On the other side of the question, Winston Churchill, bombs falling on London. Churchill doesn't talk about, hey, this is a great opportunity for urban renewal, and we can whoop the Nazis at a profit. He gets it right. I don't have a thing to offer you but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. And so we recommended that the president give the speech which he hasn't yet given. It'd be the climate equivalent of Roosevelt's Day of Infamy speech. After Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt doesn't come to the public and say, they damaged some of our boats, but, No, he said they sunk our fleet. And we're going to have to suck it up and work hard, and the greatest generation was able to do that. Now, climate change is different. It is a long-term thing, but are we capable, with the right leadership, of sucking it up and beginning to see this and respond with what frankly needs to be a sense of wartime urgency? I mean, it is going down to the wire.
Leadership in a democracy requires that there be the leadables.
followers willing to follow the lead.
And we elect these people, and we drive them, and unfortunately with the polling so predominant, we drive them all day, every day in certain directions. And you address two, what to me are just absolutely critical areas. One's that education, and how we just desperately need to rethink that. And then, of course, what we were talking about earlier, the First Amendment, but the media in general. Right. And we've got to be telling the stories. We've got to be giving young people, but really the whole community, the tool set, the perspectives, the the dramatization, the reality, in ways that leaders will do what leaders frequently do, which is run to get in front of the parade. The problem is the parade does not seem to have started.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Well, I tell you what we're doing here at Oberlin, if I can. All right, talk
please,
about my
absolutely.
Day job. 10 years ago, actually starting about 14 years ago, we decided
to
create an environmental studies center. And we want to do this in a very different way. So we want to put this incredible design team together and make this an educational project. So we opened the door to anybody who wanted to be part of the process.
That would be anybody.
So that was people in the city, students, staff, anybody that wanted to come in. And about 250 people came into the process. And the goal was to, as we make a building, to use that as a pedagogical opportunity. I don't like the word pedagogy because it sounds like a foot disease.
Yes, it does.
But, you have pedagogy, but I'm taking something for it. But to make it educational. And that worked beautifully.
A learning experience.
And also did something else. It connected young people age 18, 19, 20, 21. With incredibly accomplished people, 35 up to 80, who were part of this master group of designers around the country. So we're doing the same thing. We're going to do the whole downtown, starting with a 13-acre block that the college owns, and has a very famous art museum, as you know, and a hotel which needs to go or needs radical improvement. But to do the whole block, can you do a block, not just a building, but a block that's powered entirely by sunlight, is a zero discharge block, no waste product leaves it, made out of local materials, and then can you use that as a driver to create a green economy? And then I want to, rough numbers. 10 years to do this project, hopefully sooner, but 1,000 young people, Oberlin students, and high school kids, and kids from Votech School, along with this incredible team of designers we've assembled around the project. So the young people come through the experience, and they're part of rebuilding a town and making it carbon neutral and green and as prosperous as you can make a small town. But they've learned how to roll up their sleeves and get down to work and solve problems and do things in the world. Because the thing I fear about education is we equip young people to know lots and lots of things, but we give them no place. And if you tell people what we've been talking about, that climate change is real and biotic impoverishment is here and oceans are acidifying and all these kinds of things, you raise their anxiety level. And the question is, what do they then do? And it's too easy for them to go eat, drink, and be merry and just wipe their, or ignore it altogether. And so you've got to redirect that energy in a positive way. And you've got to change their Rolodex. So when they leave here, they've got to start. They know lots of important people who are heroes and heroines of this time. If anybody cares to look back on this time, they'll know the names of lots of people who have engaged in this process. These are going to be the leading ecological enlightenment. In the same way you connect Thomas Jefferson and Voltaire with the European Enlightenment. But.
Long before I met you, which is to say more than 15 years ago, I cut out of a magazine, David Orr, whom I will quote to himself, "Our goal as educators is to present a sense of hopefulness to students and the competence to act on that belief." That's two very important points. I once saw Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of myth, who said, the way you save the world is through tourism. Now, this was 25 years prior, and he didn't understand how costly that is to the planet with all of the things that go with tourism. If you're not going to save the world with tourism, and his point was clearly that people had to get to know each other so they'd stop killing each other, can we put the future of our planet in the hands of education?
Well, we already have. The people,
for better or worse.
For better or worse. The common denominator of all the leaders and all the people making all the decisions about the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle, those people all went to public school or private school and colleges and universities and graduate schools, and so we already have. And the question is now, can we take back the educational system and make sure that no one leaves ecologically ignorant or incompetent or unable to connect the dots or unable to think about the long term? And the long term is simply, it's that larger, that farther horizon. And if you look at that horizon now, there's a thin white line on that horizon. That's the tsunami that's approaching the shore where we're playing in the sand. And we've got to equip people to see that and understand that and take precaution and precautionary measures before, you know, we're inundated with disaster. Connecting the dots, it's no more than systems thinking. That's being able to work laterally across the curriculum, understand, gee whiz, ethics has something to do with ecology here, and economics has something to do with both of them, and that's just the scene, the pattern. So we've got, if we were to respond fully as educational institutions to this, it wouldn't be simply that we reduce our carbon emissions. It'd be that we radically alter the way we deliver knowledge and what we call knowledge. And there are lots of things that we need to keep in the curriculum, but you can make a pretty long list of everything that needs to go. And I think that there's, I want to amend that with this comment, that there's nothing inherently trivial, but there are lots of trivial ways to do anything. and so, yeah, Joseph, not Joseph Campbell, the man who wrote Lives of a Cell, Lewis Thomas, Lives of a Cell. What Lewis Thomas did in a wonderful book in such clear, compelling prose was to look at a cell, and through that lens, you could see all the rest of the world. I mean, it was a beautifully, you know, that's what I'm talking about.
I taught a television production course using that book.
Did you? Okay.
And it scared the pants off of the kids taking it, because they said, mm-hmm. Well, what does this have to do with television? We want to know how to focus. And I said, whether or not you focus the camera is utterly irrelevant if you do not look at the larger picture.
Focus of your mind.
That's right.
It's the focusing of the mind that's so critical.
And the reason that I did that was that he told me to.
Well, you mentioned...
Good for you, Bill.
We need some other people on the hook. And you know, you mentioned economics in terms of what you're doing here at Oberlin. Yeah. There's still this powerful argument that is, you know, essentially is driven by economic fundamentalists and you know, assorted right wingers, but is really permeates economic thinking, mm-hmm. that we can't, essentially it comes down to we can't afford to save the world. It's too expensive. Now, put that way, it is manifestly absurd, but essentially, I mean, this, I can't interpret it otherwise. Mm-hmm. What it, and again, you address this, the changes that are required, are, and it's Schumpeter, there are going to be some problems. Mm-hmm. Exxon, I hope, will suffer. But the economic opportunities are great. But also the role of economics in the overall culture is a mutable condition. Yeah. We've sort of assumed that it has to be this way, that economics has to drive every decision. And your argument, and I think it's a compelling argument, yours and others, is that there are other ways to live a life.
Let's come back right there in just a moment with David Orr. You can think a minute about what all those other ways to live a life might be.
Smart to say, huh?
We'll be back in a minute with David Orr. The college of which he speaks is Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, are here with David Orr. We trust that you'll be with us when the three of us return in a moment. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. Bill Russell always is pleased to be with me in conversation.
We're having entirely too much fun talking about disaster. Well, but that's part of it. This is also vital. I mean, there's a life-affirming piece of this that's that we tend to lose track of. It's real easy to say, poor me, pitiful me, and woe is me, and become paralyzed by hopelessness, but there's this opportunity to engage life in ways that we have not in generations.
Is that true, David Orr?
Oh, I think absolutely true. And Bill, and your point about humor, a friend of mine, Wes Jackson, the great soil science agronomist and plant geneticist, said once that if you can't laugh at some of this, you're just not taking it seriously enough.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dr. Jackson.
I think he was onto something. And I couldn't, you know, as serious as things are, and they are serious, I think we have to acquire a sense of humor, which is to be able to step out of ourselves and see the human experiment and this human story, what Tom Berry calls the universe story, from 35,000 feet. and be able to see ourselves with perspective. And I think that part of the problem with economics, which we were speaking just a moment ago, part of the problem with economics, there are lots of problems with the way we count for things, yeah. is that it requires us to take our condition too seriously, and we measure that, and we get very nervous about any slight fluctuation in the Dow Jones. But there's no fluctuation when species go extinct. We don't pay any attention to that. And of course, there's no prosperous economy that can be built on a planet with ruins, period. And so it's an issue of getting the cart and the horse in the right relationship. And once we've decided the right thing to do relative to climate change or whatever it might be, then the question can become economic. What's the smartest possible way to do the right thing? So I tend to see these things first as issues of ethics. But all the while, to get the cart and the horse in the right relationship, I think requires probably first kind of a sense of humor. I have on my desk, both here and at home, my patron saint, a little wooden statue of Don Quixote.
laugh because I have a statue of Don Quixote.
Well,
in my
I keep it there, and I look at that every now and then. It reminds me, probably the greatest novel ever written. But I think we need that sense of humor. I think why that's part of the reason why the Jon Stewart show, the Daily Show. Yeah. It is so powerful because people want to look at this and, what do? You just cry or, you go into a deep denial. But I think we need to...
It's also powerful, I think. I mean, the humor is an unquestionably a very important part of it and in many ways cathartic. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the few places you can get a true rendering of what's actually going on in the world, which is very important. And mm-hmm. it's one of the very few places that actually goes back and looks at the record. You know, we tend to live our lives now. Right. It's uh-huh. like skiing downhill, looking at your feet. That's a prescription for disaster.
That's good.
Yeah. And we simply have no sense of the past. And mm-hmm. one of the things the Daily Show has done is to go back into the archive and pull it out. You said this.
That's right.
Which is a direct contradiction of what you're saying today. Right. And it happens over and over and over again. It goes to mm-hmm. the issues of credibility. And it seems part of the challenge is identifying in some sort of cultural way, at least for individually, and maybe more broadly than that, culturally, mm-hmm. Who's reliable? Who do you trust? Who do you look to?
You know, if this was a baseball team, when your reliability got below 150, you ought to be taken out of the lineup. And yet you see people on the op-ed pages of some of the newspapers and still as commentators on CNN and major TV stations. Who were wrong on virtually every issue, every major issue, including the Iraq War and so forth, and yet they're still there. Some of them have drug problems, some have addiction problems of one sort or another, and yet they're still there.
Well, I think they all have addiction problems, and it's part of the cult of celebrity that we have created, and it goes, again, more broadly to the kinds of things you're talking about. To make the kinds mm-hmm. of changes you're talking about, we really have to recalibrate and maybe reinvent and perhaps reimagine who mm-hmm. and what we are as individuals and also as humans.
I want to make this very specific because mm-hmm. it could be taken as just a general philosophical conversation. It's not. You say that what I have to do and toward which I have been working is that currently, if I get my numbers right, you'll fix it if I don't, the average American uses something like 2,000 units to be units of energy a month, and that we need to be at 200 or something that is that kind of a major change mm-hmm. in our behavior. Well, we have replaced our HVAC, which dramatically dropped the use mm-hmm. of energy. We have a different dishwasher, and I use a dishwasher. Now, I don't use the dry cycle. And I live in a place in Atlanta, you got to be more careful about the water. Right. And then, of course, remember that water is needed to generate electricity. You got to think about all of those pieces. And there are things that I can do that I may not be specifically saving the world, but I feel I'm making my little contribution because I live in the developed world. And if I will do it, maybe somebody else will do it. You're talking about individual things as well as systemic things, aren't you?
Oh, sure. And I think those things are incredibly important. But there's a limit to how far that would go. And here in Oberlin, for example, part of what we're doing here to transform the town is to work through all the public policy requirements and economic changes to make it easy for people to do that, including quick feedback on behavior. So you can see your energy bill with something like a dashboard technology. My colleague here, John Peterson, has been exploring that, and it's incredibly good stuff. tie that with the smart grid, and then tie that with changes in utility policy that tell everybody your energy bill is going to go up. We'll help you keep it down by improving your efficiency, but it's going to go up. And if you don't improve your efficiency, you're going to pay a lot more. With change in the Yellow Pages, we need companies here competing for our business and providing energy services. So an energy service company that comes in and diagnoses a problem, installs equipment, and then pays for it back out of your savings. And it's an old principle. It works in California and other places. Yep. But we need to put the infrastructure for efficiency and for sustainability. And that, by and large, doesn't exist. And there are a couple of real simple things to do. I mean, in terms of public policy, we need people who understand these things. But what happens in Germany, feed-in tariffs. So if you have a photovoltaic array on your roof, you don't pay the wholesale, you don't pay the retail rate and get the wholesale rate back. You're selling power at a preferred rate, which then changes the whole incentive structure. Then people who, Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter. They may not believe in climate change. That doesn't matter. But if they just want to make money. And those little changes in public policy, feed-in tariffs, would be incredibly important.
The Canadians are doing that. I think Quebec mm-hmm. Hydro is doing that. Mm-hmm. We're restoring a place as greenly as we can in Kimberley, mm-hmm. British Columbia.
On a very, very tight budget.
And one of the really mm-hmm. impressive things, in fact, one of the things that attracted us to the community is our first exposure to it, somebody with the city said, we're committed to being carbon neutral, the city itself, mm-hmm. The city government, to being carbon neutral in 2010.
That would be
not 2020, not 2040,
weeks from
not
now.
28.
Wow.
But
they're going to make it?
Yep.
I think they will, and I'm not certain of this, but mm-hmm. I think it is a provincial-wide mandate,
yes.
And they are taxing carbon. I mean, they're doing that, but the remarkable right. thing is they are taking concrete steps. The local communities are doing what's necessary, and not everybody mm-hmm. is, you know, this, Canada's not full of tree huggers.
Mm-mm.
They're full of people that cut down trees.
Yeah.
This is an old mining town. It's, you know, heavily dependent on timber, but they understand they have gotten past denial.
Yeah, yeah.
I sometimes think that, you know, rather than a revolution, we need revolution. That a lot of what is challenging all of us
yeah.
is a mm-hmm. lack of will, a lack of the willingness to do what is necessary. And the kinds of things you're talking about, yes, Paula's a good person because she uses 40% less electricity,
mm-hmm.
but that's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
We got to go a lot further, and all of us have to do that. And I think we're still in that halfway measures. When we get really, really righteous about it, well, I'll turn off the light.
And we can't simply
I'll turn the air conditioner up.
How we right. live right now right. better. We have to rethink how we live. Right?
Mm-hmm. You're talking about a major cultural shift.
Which has to begin where we are. And the public is still part of this consumer mentality and strong belief in technology solves everything and so forth. And technology can come to our aid in some ways. It doesn't, the disagreement I have in Down in the Wire with many people who talk about climate solutions is it's not solvable. We've already committed to a substantial warming of the planet. That cannot be undone by any known means. So what can occur is we can contain the worst of what would otherwise lie ahead. And then how do we do that? And that gets into all these kinds of changes. That gets into people understanding that you've got to vote for green candidates, not because it's a nice thing to do, it's an essential thing to do. And people who understand things like feed-in tariffs, and like energy technology, and smart grid, people who have taken the trouble to understand the issues and what can be done about it. And what can be done to avoid the worst of what lies ahead is really quite substantial. Can you power Oberlin by sunlight? Absolutely. Can you power...
And this is in the northeast Ohio that's not known for its days
yeah,
of sunlight.
It's a coal region. Can you go cold turkey on coal? Well, that means undoing about a century of thinking about energy and power. But the technology allows us to do that. And eventually we have to do it anyway. Are we smart enough to figure out how to use intermittent power sources like wind power and like solar and hydro and microturbines and biomass and so forth and weave that together into a different grid that in this case is a smart grid? And so when intermittency or let's say power demand crosses some point, it shuts my refrigerator down for 20 minutes and it shuts down supermarket chillers for 15 minutes. And so you flatten out these large swings, you know, you get more of a level grid. So instead of this looking like a, somebody once describe it as an electrocardiogram, you know, it looks more like a ski slope. Mm-hmm. And that's simply the technology that now allows us to do a lot of things like that. And then distributed energy in the form of solar collectors and wind power is all available. But the first step is going to be efficiency. First step is helping people to simply take their energy budget like a wet dish rag and wring all the waste out of it. And that's probably half to two-thirds of our total electric bill.
One of the real challenges, I think, for Americans at least, and it may be a Western challenge, we sort of believe that we perfected democracy. If you vote, yeah, you've pretty much done your duty.
Mm-hmm. Not true.
And that was never the case. Mm-hmm. You actually, it's not irrelevant. You make a point about the Magna Carta that I had simply never seen. I'm accustomed to thinking that we're still arguing about the Magna Carta, about mm-hmm. whether the rich get to have special privileges or not, right, as the king sees it, the ruler sees it. But you also talk about another a subchapter that I had simply not come across before, and it recalibrates my sense of Magna Carta. Tell us about that other chapter, the access to the forest. I think this has to do with Robin Hood, doesn't it?
No, actually, it predates Robin Hood by a few centuries. This is interesting because what the Magna Carta is all about the rights of nobles, mm-hmm. and the nobles got together and forced the king to agree to, you know, certain concessions, and he had to or else. But the other part of the Magna Carta, which is not as well known, but is equally valid and in some ways more important, was the right of access, usufruct, it would be called, to the forest commons.
Say the word again?
Usufruct. U-S-U-F-R-U-C-T. It's a great word, and we don't use it much anymore.
Right. Thanks for spelling it.
It means access to a resource that you don't own. And so that means you keep it intact for those to follow. So there's certain rules about using it, or call it the commons. It's the capacity to use common properties. So the forest was held in common, and people had access to the forest as a source of fuel and food and, you know, plants and animals and so forth, as long as they didn't abuse it. And the forest charter, and you think of the commons now, understanding the commons includes your bailiwick airways, which is something we hold in common and in trust for those to follow.
Does that include things like the air?
It ought to include climate stability, air, oceans, animals, biodiversity. I mean, you think about the things that we hold in common. And of course, one of the battles through British history was this thing called enclosure, where people could come and fence off the commons and deprive people of access to it unless they paid for it. And so again, it goes back to this old economic problem of marketization of everything. And this is one of the changes I think we have to make both economically and politically, is to protect common property assets and create better fences around those, so to speak, so that they cannot be, the encroachment of the market is stopped at some point.
Well, and we cannot be fearful that somebody's going to call us a socialist, or which is sort of communist light anymore. When I was growing up, oh, you're a communist. No, actually, I believe that life on Earth is a good thing, and I'm willing to fight for that.
Right.
Well, I'm willing to struggle for that. I don't necessarily have to fight, because that takes us to one more place that we need to go before I get a sense that we need to move on. Fundamental to maybe 10,000 years of the human experience is the use of violence to solve problems, mm-hmm. and that violence being legitimized by states and states with a small s. Among the things that you think that we need to change is our relationship toward how we solve problems and the brute force solutions to which, mm-hmm. at least in the United States, we're so quick to default. Witness 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
How can that be part of confronting climate collapse?
I think it has to be an essential part to it. In the United States, we spend about $1 trillion a year on either military weapons and defense budget or war fighting. And I can't see, and we maintain somewhere, I've seen different numbers, 750 to 850 military bases around the world. I don't think we have a snowball's chance in hell of getting anything like sustainability as long as we maintain a military presence of that size and scale.
And that's before you start talking about
nuclear
weapons.
And I'm not interested in making the military more efficient. I want to make a military smaller. And I think the issue, and you can begin to look at this, look at the pattern. Our military presence enrages lots of people. That creates more terrorist threats, and that creates more problems for us. It is hugely expensive. Imagine if we could cut the military budget in half. So you have $500 billion. That solves a lot of what can be solved. Imagine that being distributed to help alleviate poverty and hunger worldwide and housing shortages and then rebuild infrastructure in our own land where the infrastructure is falling apart. And otherwise, there's not that money. And we've gone deeply into debt to maintain an empire that cannot be maintained. History shows no empire lasting long. And when they collapse, it's kind of like letting the air out of a balloon. You can't get it back in again. And the whole thing, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, once it's gone, it's gone. So
I want to say one thing before we go away from that. The other, it's a large amount of money, and it is close to 50% of what is spent in the world, which suggests that either we're grossly inefficient or we're expecting to be fighting the entire world. There's really no alternative in that, and either one of those assumptions would argue forcefully for what you're suggesting. In addition, those monies go into non-productive assets.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
from a purely economic standpoint, which is what a lot of this discussion is about, those assets are not productive assets.
That's right.
Let's go away for just a moment talking about being down to the wire with David Orr. We'll be back in just a moment. Just a couple more minutes with David Orr here at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. David Orr is known as an environmental leader. Bill Russell, Paul Gordon, David Orr, three people who care a lot about this. How do we make the world care about this?
Well, I think the good news is we are. If we'd been holding this conversation 25 years ago, we couldn't have legitimately talked about a global movement, but there is one now. And it's galvanizing around climate, around species, around development issues, justice issues, women's issues. There is now a global movement. And all of these movements are part of what Paul Hawken calls blessed unrest. And it needs lots of leadership and needs lots of more work. But there is, in fact, I think, a movement to save the planet.
Is Hawken's, that being optimistic or is that being hopeful?
Well, yeah, I think it's being hopeful. If somebody, I've said audiences around the country, if somebody's optimistic, you just don't know enough. Optimism is to, and the analogy I use in the book is it's to be a Yankees fan, and you've got two outs in the ninth inning, and two strikes on a 200 hitter, and Mariano Rivera in his prime is throwing smoke, and you're going to win the game. Now, you put your feet up, have another beer, you're going to win. Hope is to be a Cleveland Indians fan. And you've got a 200 hitter, you're down
you
two
know
runs,
about this.
And you've got a runner on second base, and that you've got to be hopeful. But I said in the book that hope is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. It requires mandatory. If you're hopeful, you have got to be active. You've got to be doing stuff. And I think the only legitimate, you can't go to despair, as Gandhi said, and as we all know, that's a sin. And optimism is just, you just don't know enough. So hope is a sweet spot. And that's the place where we need to be. And it's mandatory on us to be hopeful. But to be hopeful means you're active. I mean, it is that verb with the sleeves rolled up. You've got to be doing things.
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, hope is obviously very central. One of the other challenges, I think, is to reinvigorate the critical faculty, to examine your own life, to examine the information that's being presented, to examine what you get off television or from politicians, whatever. But that critical thinking, which we're supposed to be good at, also is very important, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And now more than ever before. We're not in the game yet. We don't have the runner on second base, so to speak. And critical thinking is being eroded by television, possibly by the internet, by too much affluence, too little parenting, indifferent schooling. I mean, there are a lot of factors that are moving in that direction. And I've run my flag personally up the pole of education.
Education is precisely what David Orr is doing by creating tangible objects from which we all can learn. He has chosen action over hand-wringing
or denial. We thank him for his work, his leadership, and his marvelous sense of humor. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.